Next case is Itochu Building Products v. United States, 2013-1044. Mr. Marshak.
Good morning. We respectfully submit to trial court abuse of discretion when it concluded that Itochu's failure to file a court characterized as, and I quote, short comment submission, close quote, constituted an appropriate reason to deny Itochu's right to obtain judicial review of the merits of his claim. In reviewing the CIT decision, we ask this court to recognize what this case is not about. This is not a case where plaintiff did not raise the issue before the agency. Itochu vigorously presented his position to high-level Department of Commerce officials.
But that's what the CIT judge said, right?
Well, the CIT judge said...
They waived it.
The CIT judge, Your Honor, said we did not renew our objection. We believe there's a tremendous distinction between making an argument before the agency and renewing our objection. What the CIT judge said we didn't do is file a short comment submission preserving position on the effective date.
He said you didn't nail it down.
Yes, Your Honor, we have many, many, many nail jobs. But we didn't have to nail it down, Your Honor. And the reason we didn't have to nail it down by filing a very short, you know, one more knock, my nail joke, one more knock on the nail, was that we made the presentation orally in writing before senior Department of Commerce officials. The department considered our determination in the preliminary determination. In fact, the department considered our submission in the final determination. The problem here, or the issue here, is whether we have to renew our objection after the preliminary determination. And we believe that the key factor and the issue of law, which the trial judge misconstrued, was the fact that in the preliminary determination, when the Department of Commerce invited comments, it did not refer to Section 351.309, which talks about filing case briefs. And when you look at the Department of Commerce regulations, 351.309 says you are required to renew your objection and to preserve your rights. Section 351.309 does not apply to this particular case.
Can I ask you,
yes,
would at least some of your arguments about the error of holding you to exhaustion apply even if 309 in fact applied here?
Your Honor, it would be a different case. I'll be very frank with you. If 351.309 applied, it would have been in the...
something like the gist of your argument to be that having told the Commerce what your legal position was, there is utterly no point in your having told them again because they were busy litigating a position, not just that they had discretion about the effective date, but that they were legally required to exclude all entries, even unliquidated entries, subject to the review. And so,
that is absolutely one of our arguments. We're saying it would be absolutely futile for us to raise this issue after the preliminary. Department of Commerce was defending this position in the Court of International Trade. We made our pitch to the Department of Commerce. They were defending the position in court. There was nothing more we could say
Understand, I mean, the position that they were taking, I think Heva Hill says this, and it quotes trustees in bankruptcy, that they lacked any discretion. They were statutorily forbidden to include entries back to the effective date.
That's what they're saying, and the court in Heva Hill has said it was an abuse of discretion for them not to go back and allow unliquidated entries to be subject to changed circumstances. We have a court. This case was going on. We were going before the Department of Commerce. There was a parallel case in the Court of International Trade where the Commerce Department was taking a position directly contrary to the position we're presenting before Commerce. It's absolutely futile for us to raise anything else with Commerce because they would have said what they would have said in the final. And the whole purpose of renewing objections, again, we made the argument, but didn't do was file the one short comment submission. We didn't file this one piece of paper. And Judge Stancil, I think he realized it would have been futile for us to file it, but he said, in his opinion, you know, you have to file it to preserve our rights. And we're saying we don't have to file it to preserve our rights because 351.309 only applies in a case brief determination. When we received that notice, Your Honor, We received a preliminary determination notice. We have to, you know, as lawyers for a client, we have to make a decision. Do we have to file another piece of paper?
And your position, I take it, is that, well, had it come as cost-free, it would have been the more conservative and cautious course to go ahead and file the piece of paper. But it didn't come cost-free because you had the extension of the period.
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand that.
That's one of our one of the reasons we didn't do it.
Right, I understand that.
It was a cost.
Ask you this, in that regard, is it clear to you that filing a, this is our position and we're sticking to it, we're not asking you to do anything new, to write a treatise, et cetera, just a one-sentence letter, but we're sticking out of the position. Is it clear to you that that would have been the kind of comment or response that would have triggered the 225, is it, extra days?
In our opinion, Your Honor,
yes.
Because we practice before the Department of Commerce every day, yes. And then that's we.
The answer is anything you said. If you said something that said, we don't like it.
The judge says, we're speculating. But it's a speculation based on a practical experience before the Department of Commerce. When you file comments, they have a tremendous caseload.
What you're speculating about is the amount of time, not the question of whether it would have triggered their entitlement to take extra time. I take it, is not speculative.
No, it definitely would have triggered their entitlement to take extra time.
All right,
they would have been entitled to take extra time, and that's something that we put into the mix when we didn't file the comments. But more importantly for us, we looked at the notice, the preliminary determination. We were sick. If 351.309 would have been there in the notice, or if the regs 351.309 would have referred to having, when you're filing just comments, you have to preserve your rights. Or if Section B of 351.309 would have referred to changed circumstances, it would have been a different situation. In our case, you look at the notice, you look at the regulations, and you say 351.309 renewal requirement doesn't apply. And renewal requirement is a unique situation because it's just renewing something that you've already said, you've already done the best job you could do, which is filing one piece of paper where you almost know that nobody's going to consider it again. And why do that? The only reason we believe you have to renew is if there's something in the statute or something in the regulation or some binding court decision saying, okay, you have to review. The statute doesn't say it. The statute says, exhaustion is where it's appropriate. You look at the regulation says, yeah, you sure better renew if you're required to file a case. And you look at this court's decision in Chorus, and they said, that's very important. There's a regulatory requirement. You have to file that one piece of paper, even though it may be futile, if you're bound by 351.309.
Now, let me see. Turning to the particular filings that you made prior to the preliminary determination.
Yes, sir.
And that would include your letter,
the
41-page submission that you made when you had the meeting with, I forget his name.
We met with Mr. Taverman, who's the decision maker, and 700 Department of Commerce officials, and we were there. It's not on the record, but to see our submission, this was a very serious meeting.
Well, wait a minute. You say it's not on the record. The
41-page submission is on the record. What went on in the meeting.
Right, okay.
In the meeting, we discussed every one of those 41 pages. We had a very serious meeting. We gave our best shot orally as we possibly could give. It's an important issue for us. We put everything out there, at this time period because we knew this was our shot at getting this thing resolved as quickly as possible.
Now, in the course of the letter or the 41 pages, did you address the legal ground employed by or adopted by Commerce in Heavy FL?
Yes, Your Honor.
Their argument that
was
where's the point in all that?
Why don't you avoid talking over the judge?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I apologize.
You got the question.
The issue there was trustees and bankruptcy. That was the case before Heavy FL. I think the name changed. But that was the case where the Department of Commerce took that position and spent a lot of time looking at these decisions in the meeting, and I think in the first page of a memorandum, which said the Department of Commerce, thinks that this is the law, and we brought the Commerce Department's attention to that.
This is JA-113, is that the
page? JA-113, and we talk about, it's paragraph 4, and we said department practice and policy are found in the attached determination. The one case which the department deviated from this practice, excluded rubber, involved a unique and complex fact pattern, which is easily distinguishable, and we said, moreover, the CIT reversed the department's adverse effective date decision and excluded rubber, and then we gave citations to all the trustees and bankruptcy cases, and that case, you know, that the judge in that case is the same judge in Hagerflow, and that's a continuation.
Okay, but I had a more specific question, and I don't think you addressed. Did you actually specifically address the argument of statutory incapacity on the part of Commerce to grant the relief you are seeking?
Your Honor, I mean, I could say, because I was at the meeting, the answer is yes. And if you look at the pages, in the 41 pages that we cite, one of those pages is going to have an excerpt from the case that where the judge, the CIT, talks about the issue in that case. So you can see, you know, that definitely was a very important issue. Because we're telling the Commerce Department, look, you know, in a particular case like this, you absolutely have the right to go back to all unliquidated entries, and you've done it in the past, and now you're trying to litigate it differently on the merits. But the court has said, you know, the statutorily, that you can go back. And these are, you know, issues that are still pending at the CIT. We had a very favorable decision. Hagerflow, the fuck decision that came out after we filed our briefs here, you know, on the merits. And that's, you know, we feel we have an excellent chance on the merits of this case.
Is it Judge Polk?
I believe it was Judge Musgrave. I'd have to go back. But it's,
go ahead.
But, you know, we have this good position on the merits, but we have to get over this hump of exhaustion, and we think the exhaustion problem comes up because we think Judge Stansu misinterpreted whether 351.309 applies, and he abused his discretion by taking a very, very harsh position, which he almost admits by when he said you only have to file you know, this one-page letter. And we're saying the one-page letter requirement, because it's obviously futile, it's obviously not saying anything new, only applies when it's very, very clear that you're bound by 351.309. In this case, it's not clear at all. In fact, you're not bound by 351.309 because the notice doesn't refer to it. And when you look at the regulations, it only applies to case briefs. And when you look at the other part of the regulation, changed circumstances is not a provision where you require case briefs. So it's limited. This renewal requirement. So as far as, you know, normal exhaustion, you know, we've exhausted. You know, we put it all out there. We said everything we could. What we didn't do was file the one piece of paper and we saying that's not required in this particular case. I'm not sure if I have 2 minutes left.
You have 2 minutes left, and we'll save it for you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Majerus?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, this appeal presents a simple issue. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in requiring exhaustion and finding that Itochu failed to exhaust when Commerce issued a preliminary determination, invited the parties to comment, and Itochu filed no comments? Now, the exhaustion requirement here is statutory. It's under 28 U.S.C. section 2637. And this court, this court has held that that's a strict requirement.
Well, now, there are certainly exhaustion, statutory exhaustion requirements that are congressionally mandated, strict. You must exhaust in all cases, no ifs, ands, and buts, with a couple of exceptions or right around the edges. But this statute says exhaustion is required if appropriate. I mean, that sounds like Congress is basically saying exhaust if, in the course of deciding these cases, it looks like the kind of situation in which exhaustion ought to be required, which isn't mandating anything as far as I can see.
It's not mandating exhaustion, but it's giving the Congress gave the court the authority to decide if it was appropriate, and this is a perfect example of where exhaustion was appropriate. because of what happened. The context.
Well, I can think of a better example of a case where exhaustion would be appropriate. This one, actually, I find quite difficult. I know you. This is your position, that it's a perfect example, but it doesn't look like a perfect example.
Well, under this court's precedent, the situation is very analogous to recent cases from this court, in particular, Forrestal. So in this situation, we had it was a changed circumstances review that was requested about a year and a half after the initial anti-dumping review. Mid-Continent filed for it seeking a partial revocation as to four types of routine nails.
Can I just focus? I mean, I keep fastening, I guess, on the aspect that I asked your opposing counsel about. It was Commerce's position in this case that you were legally required to do what you did here. That this wasn't a matter of discretion, of policy balancing, and this was the position that you had argued in the trustees of North American Bankruptcy and in Kivafil. Chorus was not that. Chorus was a case in which exhaustion actually might well have served a purpose because the issue was one that was concededly by Commerce within its discretion. And so maybe if you had been presented additional facts or better policy arguments, you might have changed your mind. But when the issue is one on which Commerce's position is, our hands are tied by the statute. There is nothing you can tell us that is going to allow us to do what you think makes sense, even if we thought it made sense.
But that's not the case here. The court in the Hebefil matter noted that Commerce does have the discretion to decide.
But disagreeing with your position.
That wasn't Commerce's position, right?
I'm sorry, I don't
It wasn't Commerce's position that it had the discretion.
It is their position that they have the discretion. It's based on policy decisions on what appropriate effective date to choose. And that's exactly what the court in Hebefil noted. They noted that in that case, it was the whole issue was whether Congress's hands were tied in terms of selecting an effective date, and the court recognized that's not the case.
You're saying that Commerce, it is not Commerce's position that they are legally compelled to adopt a starting date other than the one for which Itachu is arguing?
In this circumstance, it's an issue of Commerce's practice. But aside from the merits of the effective date issue, we can't even get there because Itachu failed to exhaust in this circumstance.
No. Whatever Commerce's position may be now after the 2012 decision in Hebefil, in 2011, in March and April of 2011, when the events, relevant events here, it was it not, Commerce's position that, and I'm going to quote from Hebefil, Commerce previously claimed that 1675A, I guess that's the administrative review, precludes the inclusion of unliquidated entries subject to a completed administrative review within the scope of a changed circumstances review. That the statute actually said, you may not do this.
Your Honor, that...
I think that's... and it cites...
Is that not what Commerce's... Is the court wrong in saying that was Commerce's position at that time?
Your Honor, the Hebefil case dealt with different factual circumstances. And the problem here is really fundamentally that what the CIT is reviewing is Commerce's determination at the administrative level. They weren't even able to make that determination. And bearing in mind that the final determination is what the CIT is reviewing, not the preliminary determination.
Well, they reiterated the position in the preliminary determination in the final determination.
They noted it in a footnote. And I think it's important to keep in mind that in the preliminary determination, they simply documented in the background discussion at the very beginning of the preliminary determination that Itochu had taken a position as to the effective date and that a meeting took place. Well, we don't have a transcript. We don't know what necessarily took place in that meeting. But the fundamental problem is that after the preliminary determination was issued, how does Commerce know that they're preserving their argument? Maybe they decided it wasn't worth litigating any further. They had no indication whatsoever that Itochu was maintaining its position. And because of that, Commerce stayed with its position in the preliminary determination and noted it in a footnote. In the footnote in the record, it's on page 104, I believe, simply noted that this is what we had raised in our preliminary determination and this is our position. But without having the argument from the parties, they had no basis to change their position. The court has routinely held both in Middle Steel and in Chorus Stahl that Commerce can be persuaded And this was certainly in a circumstance where they could have been persuaded to go the other way. But without having that argument, they have no basis.
Which would have required them, I take it, to take a position contrary to the one they were litigating then in Hebrew.
Well, that case dealt with different factual circumstances. It wasn't addressing this product in particular and didn't involve the same administrative review.
What important factual distinctions were there between that case and this one that could have led Commerce, consistent with the position of litigating in Hebephil, to reach a different result in this case?
Your Honor, because the product that was at issue and the review and everything that was involved was different.
Why does that matter?
Because in this instance, those determinations are important, and part of this, I think, dips into the pure legal question exception and whether that would be...
That's what we're focusing
right.
on.
I would. This case is more similar to Consolidated Variants, which is a decision of this court, from opinions such as Agro-Dutch. And the distinction is, Agro-Dutch is a case relied upon by counsel. In that court, and the Federal Circuit in that court held that the CIT did not abuse its discretion in finding that this exception was applicable. That case dealt with a very narrow issue, and the court recognized it was a simple issue of statutory interpretation. The only issue there was whether an importer was affiliated with a foreign company subject to the duties. And therefore, that was it. That was the ballgame in Agro-Dutch. In Consolidating Variants, by contrast, the court stressed that we're looking at the practice of commerce. And the practice of commerce here, it was the issue of the effective date. And the CIT has held that the effective date issue is discretionary. They held that in Okaya and also in Parksdale. So that's the distinction. There was simply an issue of statutory interpretation in Agro-Dutch, but in Consolidated Variants, it went beyond that. It went to Commerce's practice, and the court in Consolidated Variants held that the CIT abused its discretion in applying the exception. For that reason, we believe that the pure legal question exception does not apply. Moreover, the court has also rejected the use of the pure legal question exception when it refers to a second-step Chevron issue. That was recognized by the Court of International Trade in Fuwei. This is clearly a second-step Chevron determination. It's not a simple statutory interpretation issue. This is a decision by Commerce about what effective date is appropriate. And without having that argument there, Commerce had no basis for fleshing out and discussing that to a fuller extent in its final determination. They simply didn't have any arguments from the parties. And so because of that, Forrestal seems shockingly similar to this case. In that case, you had an issue of where Commerce had made a preliminary determination that Corus had absorbed anti-dumping duties had absorbed anti-dumping duties rather than passing it on to its customers. That was the preliminary determination in Corus. Commerce invited comment. Corus did not file anything, and therefore Commerce adopted its preliminary, essentially the same position in its final determination. And this court held that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in requiring exhaustion and finding that Corus failed to exhaust because they didn't put Commerce on notice, did not give Commerce any indication that they maintained their argument, that they abandoned their argument. And without that, Commerce didn't have a basis to articulate its position in the final papers beyond the preliminary.
Commerce articulated its position in the preliminary of a couple of paragraphs, which in my experience is consistent with the way Commerce typically deals with issues that Commerce has previously dealt with in other reviews and simply says this has been our position, it's still our position, and we're sticking to it. Suppose that a one-line letter had been sent to Commerce, as the trial judge suggested, in response to the preliminary. Do you suppose that Commerce would have, in its final determination, written a much longer exegesis on this issue? Is it realistic to suppose that?
I think that would be speculating in terms of what Commerce would do. They may not have provided more analysis, but not having that position is precisely the problem. And this court noted that in Middle Steel, which is also a similar case. The court very clearly stated they have to provide some kind of indication that they maintain their prior position.
To what end, though? That's the question. I mean, if we were talking about a statutory mandate, then the answer would be yes. If we were talking, for example, about maintaining a position in a court of appeals with respect to an issue that the court has already, a previous panel of the court has decided, all you have to do is put in a footnote and you expect the court to reject it, but you have to put in the footnote. But the question here with respect to exhaustion, which the Supreme Court has repeatedly said is a matter of weighing and balancing, the question is, what is the realistic expectation that some benefit would flow from the one-sentence letter? And I'm struggling to see that there would be any benefit under all the circumstances of this case. Other than, you know, giving Commerce an opportunity to perhaps decide to write something on this. But how likely is that, I guess, as a practical matter?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind as well the framework in terms of timing here. So the applicable statutes and regulations state that if no party files comments, then 45 days Commerce will make a determination. If a party files a comment, it could take up to 270 days. Now, there are a variety of different kinds of changed circumstances reviews. They can be as complex as your typical administrative review involving margin calculations, and that explains why there is such a period of time that's given. Council makes a big issue about, well, we didn't file something because Commerce would have taken 270 days. That's speculative.
In the realm of, I guess, the same realm that Mr. Marshak talked about. He said, in his experience, Commerce does, in fact, they get a comment that triggers a right to add 9 months or whatever it is, and typically, yeah, they do it. Do you have any representations on that score? I mean, in general, nobody does anything before they have to. That's a good default rule. But
I think it depends on the circumstances of the case, and the reason I point that out is by having a party file something, it gives Commerce has additional time to consider the issue. But again, it's an issue, we're really speculating what
additional
analysis.
Well, we're speculating about how much time there was, but what's not speculative, it seems to me, is that there would be at least the risk that a significant additional period of time would be consumed had there been a result. So the whole point is normally in exhaustion situations, there's no cost to exhausting. You go ahead, send in the letter, you're done, you've taken care of the exhaustion problem, you've taken an issue off the table. Here, however, unusual but nonetheless present, is that there is something on the other side of the table. How big the something would be, we don't know. But we do know that there is a risk of a significant additional period of time, which is prejudicial to them.
But it's prejudicial to Commerce to not have the comments from the parties. Council knew the position of Commerce on this issue. They could have tried to persuade them the other way, and that's exactly what the court emphasized in Forrestal and Middle Steel. Without having that argument, though, Commerce doesn't have a basis or doesn't have reason, really, to more thoroughly expound its position. And that's why the additional time is there, so they can consider those issues. I see I'm running out of time. I just wanted to briefly touch upon Council's discussion of the regulation. It's 351.309. Council is misreading this provision. Under subsection B, it says that Commerce may request written argument on any issue from any person at any time. Very open-ended, not restricted to a changed circumstances review. And then it doesn't state that Commerce must request a case brief, that if this regulation is applicable. It says under subsection C1 that any party may submit a case brief. So Commerce sought comments, and counsel could have submitted a case brief. And subsection C2 states that you must present arguments, even if you raise them before the preliminary determination, you've got to raise them again, and that's not what happened here. So for all of these reasons, we would ask that this court affirm the Court of International Trade's decision and find that the CIT did not abuse its discretion in requiring exhaustion.
Thank you, Mr. Mazuris. Mr. Marshak has little time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of points. First, on page 144 of the Joint Appendix, you have the trustees in bankruptcy decision, and where it has Commerce's position, and I'll quote from the case, Commerce claims that 19 U.S.C. 1675A unambiguously precludes the inclusion of unliquidated entries subject to a completed administrative review when the scope of a changed circumstance review. That was Commerce's position at that time. The court recognized it. We discussed that. That was in the documents that we submitted to the Commerce Department. That was discussed in Commerce. So it would be absolutely futile for us to file additional comments, and also it's a pure question of law. Pure question of law is what Commerce thinks what the law is. We may say Commerce has discretion, and according to Hyperfield, Commerce So the Commerce abused its discretion. Commerce's position at that time was, this is the law. If Commerce thinks that's the law, it is a pure question of law, and there's really nothing we could have said or done that could have changed Commerce's mind on that. Talking about our 351.309 and the notice and the requirement there, if you have a normal notice that Commerce gives after an administrative review, which says interested parties may submit case briefs and or written comments. In our notice, it says interested parties are invited to comment. So not a case brief. So there's a real distinction between a normal notice that talks about case briefs and our notice that didn't say anything about case briefs. Also, you look at Corus, and I think that's important. The Corus decision by this court, two very important points. The first point is the court expressly referred to the fact that the requirement of renewing is a requirement explicitly imposed by the agency as a precondition to judicial review. And that renewal requirement is the regulation. And then they said Commerce has provided nothing by way of affirmative justification for its failure to raise the duty absorption issue. Nor has Commerce suggested why it's burdensome. In our case, we provided reasons why we did not file that short summary renewal letter that would have been ignored by Commerce and which was futile. In Corus, they just claimed they didn't have to do it. We're saying we've given a lot of reasons. It would have taken more time. 359.309 was not cited in the notice, and it's a pure question of law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Marsha.
I apologize, Your Honor, for talking to you. I'm excited.
We'll take the case under advisement.